This is Pat, and I am joining you today reading from the Clinton Journal for Friday, March the 20th. From the front page, developer proposes to build 30 multi-unit homes in Clinton. Gordon Woods reporting. The city of Clinton is moving forward with its efforts to encourage more residential development. Tony Cacomo of Heartland Development Systems, LLC, addressed the City Council on Monday with his company's plans in the city. Cacomo said the building company he works with has built some 150 homes in the past 2 years, about 400 in the past 5 years, from Iowa to Illinois. It was the builder responsible for erecting 30 homes in Hayworth along Route 51. Very simple, basic housing, Cacomo said. Most of these were IDA, International Development Association development, so they are very low income. Heartland currently has a project underway in Maroa, which involves four buildings containing four units in each building. Heartland includes people with marketing, finance, and construction expertise. Cacomo said Heartland is currently looking at a parcel located along Route 54 across from Dollar General. That's a really attractive piece, he said. Cacomo recognized the pressure the city was currently under to provide housing in light of two manufacturers, Quickwall and Meyer Utility Structure, opening manufacturing facilities in Clinton. Initially, Heartland is looking to build two unit homes in Clinton. A lot of people think it's a duplex, Cacomo said. It can be that if you wish, but the one that we have, a model we have in Iliopolis, where our factory is, the owner lives in one site and rents the other one out. He said the homes are especially an attractive option for people wanting to move from apartments into entry-level housing. Cacomo said Heartland felt owner-occupied multi-unit homes could solve some of the country's housing problems. Cacomo gave the council what he referred to as a ballpark idea of what could happen in Clinton. If we put in 30 to 32 units, somewhere between 26 to 20 of the two units I have showed you a picture of, and 4 to 5 units that are smaller, Cacomo said. You try to do a combination of these because you need to transition from that lower-end housing to this. This is how you transition from a 4 to a 2. He said Heartland was working to be able to issue bonds for the project. He said building housing on the selected site would boost property tax revenue for the land from $600 a year to around $190,000 a year. That would give you an awful lot of money to work with to help pay for the bond that's going to pay for the infrastructure, Cacomo said. Cacomo said officials from Governor Pritzker's office came to the area to learn about the plan and were interested to find out more. There's no easy answer for all of it, but if you combine a couple of these ideas together, if you look at our plans, there are very common sense. Heartland would be able to take advantage of tax increment financing, TIF, benefits if the city is successful in implementing a new TIF district. And another front page story, the Illinois Supreme Court considers another FOID challenge. Greg Bishop, the Center Square. Springfield. The Illinois Supreme Court continues to hear cases challenging the state's laws around possessing firearms. Malik Cedric Bright had his Illinois firearms owner's ID card revoked after being arrested in Cook County in 2023 and charged with felony aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. He was not convicted of the charge and had his card reinstated. Representing the state, Attorney Carson Griffiths said the issue is of no legal significance. Bright's challenge to the temporary suspension of his FOID card is moot, Griffiths told the justices Tuesday in Springfield. His FOID card was reinstated in May of 2023, and he did not make a clear showing of any mutinous exception applies. Representing Bright, attorney Thomas Magg said his client's rights were violated. My client is a nonviolent person. He is generally innocent man who was generally falsely arrested and generally violated of his constitutional rights, Magg told the justices. Magg argued there are no founding era principles that allow governments to go as far as, he said, Illinois State Police went with Bright. There is no historical analog to simply saying, I accuse you of a crime, therefore you cannot keep and bear arms, Magg said. But Griffiths, defending the FOID law, said courts have given guidance on the issue. Federal courts of appeals have issued several decisions that have uniformly upheld a similar federal law that prohibits the acquisition of firearms, Griffiths said. The justices took the case under advisement and could rule on the issue in the weeks or months ahead. The Illinois Supreme Court last week heard cases concerning firearms possession. A separate case involving the FOID requirement to possess a firearm within one's own residence was bounced around Illinois judicial system for years. In 2020, the Illinois Supreme Court majority opinion didn't make a decision on the constitutionality of the law in Vivian Brown's case, but instead cited a court rule calling into question the process the circuit court used. In 2022, the Illinois Supreme Court again sent the case back, ordering a modified circuit court order that was originally entered in 2020. Brown's case continues to linger. A White County, Illinois circuit judge last year found the state's FOID card unconstitutional when enforced against someone possessing their firearms in their home. This morning we have two obituaries to report. The first is Paula K. Mills, 77, of Clinton, who passed away on March the 12th at the Vanderleef Living Center, Mount Pulaski, where she received exceptional care for the past 7 months. Services will be conducted at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, March the 21st, at the Clinton United Methodist Church, with Pastor Darrell Howard officiating. Burial will follow at the Mausoleum Park Cemetery. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 on Friday, March the 20th, at the church. Calvert Funeral Home of Clinton is in charge of arrangements. Our second obituary is Beverly Ann Reynolds of Clinton, who passed away peacefully on March the 12th. Funeral services were held at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, March the 18th, at Calvert Funeral Home in Clinton, with Scott Marsh officiating, and burial followed at the DeWitt Cemetery. And now, from the op-ed page, the On Point column by Richard Corrett, Observations of the Week. I write this column on the morning of the primary election. Elections in this country should always make us pause and remember what we all too often take for granted. The rest of the world simply envies. We are a free nation, and that is not said lightly. One candidate will win today, and one candidate will lose. That is the reality of elections. I congratulate the candidates on their efforts. Each candidate has bared their soul to the public by asking for your vote. In a small community, that takes some guts and resolve. The candidates either know you personally, or they know someone who you also know. Congratulate the winners and respect the efforts of those who have lost. Having run a few races, I can say with certainty that it is a lot more fun to win than to lose. I can also say without hesitation that losing in an election provides a time for self-introspection like nothing else. By the time this column hits the press, we shall know the results. Regardless of winning or losing, each candidate should be appreciated for making democracy work in this nation. Today it is also St. Patrick's Day. I remember as kids you had to wear something green or else. Law school was a different time. Many of my classmates could hardly wait for that last class to end as they were going to the bar to get soused on green beer. Carbondale well deserved its reputation as a party school in the 80s. We had two kids then, and our night out might have been corned beef and cabbage if we could have afforded a night out. Many of today reflect on what the Irish have done for this nation. There have been Irish parades for over 200 years. Chicago and New York are the cities today that truly emphasize Irish history. Many Irish came to the U.S. after the potato famine in Ireland. So many came that many areas of the country put out a sign saying, "No Irish need apply," at their job sites. The Irish persevered and today are a truly integral part of American society. My high school mascot was a leprechaun, and it was a truly German farming community. I am not an advocate of McDonald's fast food. However, in March of every year, I have made the drive-through at McDonald's for my Shamrock Shake. America is the land of many nationalities, and the Irish have made sure that they are positively remembered. On a more serious note, was the news this week that the entire electrical grid of Cuba failed. The only electricity in Cuba was with private backup generators. That is a major catastrophe. It demonstrates how poor of a job Cuba has done in keeping its infrastructure maintained and how vulnerable Cuba is to an outside power attacking it. It also should give serious warning to the United States. Engineers have said for years that our electrical grid needs massive upgrades and redundancy components. We may have the most powerful military in the world, but if our nation loses its basic electrical grid, there can be chaos in the streets. Our electrical grid and substations are certainly susceptible to terrorist attack, as we have simply failed to protect our electrical system. In today's world, there are many in the Middle East that have a serious grudge against the U.S. The risk is real, and we as a country need to take measures to protect American infrastructure from those threats. Lastly, it is Illinois, and while I write this, it is winter. By the weekend, we will see the 70s. Go figure. Richard Koritz is an Illinois native attorney and former DeWitt County State's Attorney. And this morning's Prairie Doc column is Old Age, Only 10 Years Away by Dr. Becca Jordra. Every year I ask my students, how old is old? The answers vary, but the most honest response I've ever received came from a patient who said, old is 10 years older than my age. We all tend to push aging just out of reach, as though it belongs to someone else. As a physical therapist, professor, and researcher in aging, I see the consequences of that distance every day. When we mentally place older adults in a separate category, we give ourselves permission to speak and act in ways that quietly do harm. We call someone an old lady without pause. We dismiss a symptom as expected at your age. We offer the well-meaning but quietly deflating compliment that someone is doing well for their age. Each of these small moments narrows what we believe is possible for that person. This is ageism, generally unintentional, ever present in our society. The problem is not acknowledging that aging brings real changes. It does. Health conditions, pain, and mobility challenges become more common with age. but not in some uniform pattern that warrants focus on a number. The problem is when age becomes the answer rather than the starting point. When decline is the expectation, we stop asking about goals, we stop noticing strengths, and we start designing lives around an assumed limitation. Consider a common piece of advice. Move to a single-story home as you grow older. It sounds reasonable, but research tells a more nuanced story. Studies have found that those living in homes with stairs showed less decline in physical function over time compared to those without. Climbing stairs is demanding. Repetitive physical work for the legs and heart. Removing that daily challenge in the name of safety may quietly accelerate the very decline we hope to prevent. This pattern holds more broadly. Research consistently shows that vigorous exercise, not just gentle stretching or slow walks, produces the greatest health benefits as we age. Higher intensity activity improves strength, balance, heart health, and cognitive function in people well into their 80s and 90s. When we steer older adults toward only the lightest, most cautious forms of movement, we deprive them of the very stimulus their bodies need. In trying to protect, we inadvertently take away opportunity. Language works the same way. When family members, neighbors, and healthcare providers speak as though decline is inevitable, we coach people toward caution, avoidance, and withdrawal. Expectation shapes behavior, and low expectations are their own kind of harm. The answer is not to ignore age or pretend it doesn't matter. It is to treat aging as a human experience, seeing a person not as a number, but as an individual with unique aspirations, interests, and abilities. None of us are exempt from aging. We're all at just different points on the same road. The assumptions we make about older adults today are the assumptions that may one day be made about us. That alone is reason enough to think more carefully about what we say, what we recommend, and what we decide is possible with each passing year. Dr. Georgia is a professor of physical therapy in the School of Health Sciences at the University of South Dakota. She earned her Doctor of Physical Therapy degree from Duke University in 2002 and her PhD in Health Sciences from the University of South Dakota in 2021. She is board certified in geriatric physical therapy and a certified exercise expert for aging adult. Her research centers on healthy aging, with a particular focus on athletes age 50 and older. And a column from Savvy Senior, What Happens If You Die Without a Will, by Jim Miller. Dear Savvy Senior, I put off making a will for years. What actually happens to my money and property if I die without one? Signed, Getting Old. Dear Getting, if you die without a will, your assets will be distributed according to the laws of your state, known as intestacy laws. These laws determine who inherits your property and financial accounts when there's no will or trust. Since rules vary from state to state, it's important to check the specifics of where you live. A helpful starting point is airbase.com, which offers intestacy evaluators for 37 states. You enter your household information and see how your estate might be distributed. If your estate isn't included, NOLO has a useful state-by-state interstate succession guide at nolo.com/legal-encyclopedia/interstate-succession. In the meantime, here is a general overview of what can happen depending on your family situation. Married with children. When a married person with children dies without a will, all property, investments, and financial accounts that are jointly earned automatically goes to the surviving co-owner without going through probate, which is the legal process that distributes deceased person's assets. But for all other separately owned property or individual financial accounts, laws of most states award 1/3 to 1/2 to the surviving spouse, while the rest goes to the children. Married with no children, some states award the entire estate to the surviving spouse or everything up to a certain amount. For example, the first $100,000. But many other states award only 1/3 to 1/2 of the decedent's separately owned assets to the surviving spouse, with the remainder generally going to the deceased person's parents, or if the parents are dead, to brothers and sisters. Jointly owned property, investments, financial accounts, or community property automatically goes to the surviving co-owner. Single with children. All states laws provide that the entire estate goes to the children in equal shares. If the adult child of the decedent has died, then that child's children, the decedent's grandchildren, split their parents' share. Single with no children or grandchildren. In this situation, most state laws favor the deceased person's parents. If both parents are deceased, many states divide the property among the brothers and sisters. And if they are not living, their children, your nieces and nephews. If there are none of them, it goes to the next of kin, or if there's no living family, the state takes it. Make a will. To ensure your assets go to those you want to receive them, you need to create a will or trust. If you have a simple estate and an uncomplicated family situation, there are do-it-yourself resources that can help you create all these documents for very little money. Some top-rated options include Quicken Will Maker and Trust for around $109. And Trust and Will, about $199. Or if that's more than you're willing to pay, you can make your will for free at freewill.com or doyourownwill.com. However, you want or need assistance if you have a complicated financial situation, blended family, or have considerable assets, you should hire an attorney. An experienced attorney will make sure you cover all your bases, which can help avoid family confusion and squabbles after you're gone. Costs will vary depending on where you live, but you can expect to pay anywhere between $200 and $1,000 for a will. The National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys and the American College of Trust and Estate Counsel websites are good resources that have directories to help you find someone in your area. And now, answering some common questions about Easter. Easter is an important day on the Christian calendar. According to the Compact Atlas of Global Christianity, roughly 2.6 billion people across the globe identify as Christians. As Easter Sunday approaches, answering some frequently asked questions about this important holiday can be a great way for Christians and non-Christians to refresh their knowledge and may even learn something new about the holiday. What does Easter celebrate? Christians believe that God raised Jesus from the dead 3 days after his crucifixion, and Easter celebrates the resurrection of Jesus Christ. For believers, the resurrection is the cornerstone of the Christian faith and represents victory over sin and death, as well as the promise of eternal life for those who follow Christ. Do all Christians celebrate Easter on the same day? No. Most Christian churches adhere to the Gregorian calendar and celebrate Easter on what is widely referred to as Easter Sunday by secular organizations and other agencies. But Christian Orthodox churches utilize the Julian calendar to determine when to celebrate Easter. Because of the difference between these calendars and the way the date is calculated, the celebrations sometimes fall on different Sundays. That is why there is some disparity between the timing of Easter celebrations within Christian churches. How did Good Friday get its name? Non-Christians may wonder why Christians characterize the day Jesus Christ was crucified as good. Though the notion of Jesus Christ being subjected to abuse and crucifixion is anything but good, Christians believe Christ's willingness to be crucified for their sin ensured their redemption. In addition, Trinity College noticed that good in this context refers to something holy or pious, reflecting the sacred significance of the day rather than the suffering that occurred. What is Holy Week? Holy Week is the week leading up to Easter and is considered one of the most significant periods in the Christian calendar. Various days during Holy Week have their own special meaning to Christians. Palm Sunday, Holy Wednesday, Maundy Thursday, Good Friday, and Holy Saturday each commemorates events in the final day of Christ's life before his resurrection. How does the Easter Bunny fit into the Christian celebrations of Easter? Though it's easy to dismiss the Easter Bunny as a secular symbol that has little to do with faith-based celebrations of Easter, reality is not so simple. According to the Smithsonian, archaeologists believe humans lived during the Neolithic Age, viewed hares as a symbol of rebirth and assigned religious significance to burial rituals in which Neolithic peoples buried hares alongside human remains. So while an abnormally large bunny delivered candy and chocolate eggs might not have anything to do with the faith-based Easter celebration, the choice of animal may bear some relation to the celebration of the resurrection of Christ. Easter is the celebratory day on the Christian calendar and is widely observed by Christians around the world. In 2026, Easter will be celebrated on Sunday, April the 5th in most Christian churches. Orthodox Christian churches will celebrate Easter on Sunday, April the 12th. Hop on these tips for a great Easter egg hunt. Egg hunts are a traditional component of many people's Easter celebrations. Children often delight in searching for eggs around the house or in the backyard. Egg hunts are so popular that they have become a component of many town-sponsored festivities. In fact, the White House hosts its annual Easter egg roll each year. There are many ways to make Easter egg hunts more enjoyable and productive for the participants of all ages. Try these excellent ideas. Designate a clear hunting area. Young children can grow frustrated searching for eggs in large areas. Set parameters for the search area that are manageable depending on the ages of the children participating. If you'll be in a large yard or field, tape off the search area perimeter. Vary the prizes. Candy seems to be the name of the game on Easter, but too many sweets can lead to stomach aches for young Easter celebrants. Instead, mix and match prizes contained in the eggs. Candy can be in some, money in others, and perhaps small toys in a few eggs. Another clever idea is to mix the egg hunt with charades. Put charade prompts in some eggs so that the kids have to act out what they read inside for added fun. Keep a master list. It can be hard to remember where each egg is hidden, so keep a running list of where they are so that you don't discover an egg, chocolate egg, filled egg teeming with ants come summertime. Easter egg hunts are a time-honored tradition. The opportunities for fun are endless when the families plan accordingly. And with that, I'm going to hop on out of here for this week, and I'll be back next week.